Welcome to the Leadership Playbook, the show where successful leaders share what they learned to get to where they are. This podcast is an offshoot of the Albers Executive Speaker Series.
And it's brought to you by RSM US LLP, the nation's leading provider of assurance, tax, and consulting services focused on the middle market.
I'm your host, Joe Phillips, the Dean of Seattle University's Albers School of Business and Economics. Our guest today is Governor Christine Gregoire, CEO of Challenge Seattle. Challenge Seattle is a group of 21 of our region's largest employers dedicated to addressing some of the Puget Sound's most important challenges. Governor Gregoire grew up in Auburn, Washington, and earned her undergraduate degree at the University of Washington before pursuing her law degree at Gonzaga. After law school, she started working in the state attorney general's office, and in 1988 was appointed to run the State Department of Ecology. In 1992, she ran successfully for attorney general and held that post until running for governor in 2004. She served as governor of our state until 2013, and during that time took on many important issues in education, health care, and transportation, all while navigating the state economy through the Great Recession. In 2015, she participated in the launch of Challenge Seattle and has been doing that work since. So, Governor, thank you so much for joining us today on the Leadership Playbook. It's a great privilege to have you here with us today.
Nice to be with you, Joe. Thank you for the invitation.
Thank you. So, being an economist, the first question I want to ask is, you know, you did lead the state very well through that Great Recession about a decade ago, and now we're battling another economic slowdown. It's obviously brought upon by different circumstances, but what do you think the keys to successfully navigating that were back in the Great Recession, and are there any lessons for us in the current situation?
These recessions couldn't be more dissimilar. The one that we experienced when I was in office really fundamentally was about the whole structure, the economic structure, the banks, and so on. That's not what we're experiencing right now, obviously the result of COVID. At the same time, we went on for, as I recall, 8 continuous quarterly projections about our economy going down. And that has not been the case in this particular instance. Also, the federal government refused to provide any help whatsoever to the states, cities, and counties during that time, which I think, looking back, was a terrible mistake on their part. But having said all that, we really undertook, while I was in office, to ask ourselves, how could we prepare ourselves to come out of the recession? So we did more work to kind of consolidate things, to shut down things that really were outdated and needed to be shut down, things we could never have done during economic good times. And they've stood the test of time. And so it helped us come out of the recession. Fortunately, we were one of the first in the states to do so. And over the next several years, we were number one in the country. So I look back at that and say, there's no reason why we can't replicate that here. And that is because we have a sound economic base. Back in the day, it was too dependent on one company, Boeing. It is no longer dependent on one employer. It's now got a much more diverse set of employment, and technology is a big part of that. So there's no reason why we can't come out of this recession, similar to how we did the last in terms of timeliness and success. But this recession is different in one way that requires really a lot of attention. And that is that we have lost a lot of small businesses in particular, which are kind of the heartbeat of a community. And it's going to take a lot of planning, a lot of work, injection of revenue to get people back to work and those businesses up and running again. And so there's a real challenge to be had across the state with respect to that. We couldn't raise revenue back then because it required a 2/3 majority vote of the Senate. After the recession, they got rid of that requirement. So there is the potential to raise revenue here for that purpose, to help in that regard and some other key priorities that COVID have brought forth to our state. So having said that, while they're very different, the underpinnings of our economy are very similar to back then. We were successful coming out and in the long haul. There's no reason why we can't do that again.
Great. Thank you. Good insights there. So I mentioned in the intro that you are the CEO of Challenge Seattle. So it may be a group that some listeners have heard about, but they don't know much about. So maybe you could talk a little bit about what is Challenge Seattle's mission?
So Challenge Seattle is about 6 years old. We came together because we are the home of so many global companies now, whether it's Amazon, Microsoft, Starbucks, Costco, you name it. And what happened by that growth becoming so global was the attention of many of the companies went externally and wasn't looking internally in our own backyard, and we were lacking civic leadership. So we came together as a group of three nonprofits, the rest for profits, for a total of 21, to ask how can we contribute to the vibrancy of the economy, the quality of life, and take on some tough challenges in the community through civic leadership provided by these CEOs. The other interesting thing, particularly for you, I think would find interesting, is despite the fact that these are all CEOs, they didn't know each other very well. And this has given them the opportunity to do so. All meetings that we have are CEO only. If the person can't attend, the chair is vacant. That has created a real collegiality. They now work together on a whole lot of things outside Challenge Seattle because they have found common interests, common purpose in giving back to the community at large. So it has been a really good exercise to bring these folks together, as evidenced by the fact that the public-private partnership through COVID was led by Challenge Seattle. The business community at large participated, but led by Challenge Seattle, and has been unbelievably successful, been ranked by Fortune magazine, New York Times, as the model of how things should have happened across the country.
So in these 6 years, what's been the most exciting part for you as CEO?
We deal with a number of issues: transportation, education, K through 12, middle-income housing, because we think it's being eroded and we're losing fundamentals. We pay a lot of attention to homelessness and low income. We don't pay much attention to middle income, and yet that's the congestion because people are having to move away and then travel to work on a daily basis. But I would say probably the most exciting is the last year, where we have just been going one after another. From the time COVID hit, we began our first daily briefing with the science and the data and the experts on March 2. Our two biggest members at the time, Amazon and Microsoft, shut down on March 3 and worked from home. And they continued to lead throughout. Then when the racial equity issues rose to the fore, we spent 6 months on an educational journey, an awareness journey, resulted in an unprecedented set of commitments that we've grown now to over 70 companies and CEOs with a dozen sponsors. And now we're working on homelessness because we think chronic homelessness is going to be a barrier to economic recovery. People's lives are being cut short because they're chronically homeless. And our community at large is concerned, dramatically concerned about this issue and wants something done yesterday. So this year has been a year that has just been packed with issue after issue and opportunity to really have public-private partnerships so that we can make good progress.
If I can take you back to the second thing you were referencing, I think you're implicating the Washington Employers for Racial Equity Initiative, which is a pretty new initiative, and I'm not sure if many listeners know much about it. So maybe you could give us a little bit more insight on what's behind that program and what you're hoping to accomplish there.
Sure. So when George Floyd died, was killed, there was a lot of concern, and you may recall a lot of businesses began making public statements. And we had an emergency meeting and we talked about, if you're going to make a public statement, you got to say something and it's got to be meaningful and you've got to carry it out. So rather than make a public statement as Challenge Seattle, instead we went on kind of a listening, learning tour, journey, if you will, where we had Boston Consulting Group come in and do significant data analysis for us that showed that Washington State, greater Seattle area, is practically no different than any other state or any other major region in terms of the racial inequities that we experience. We went through some training, Racial Equity Institute out of North Carolina. All the CEOs went through it. We raised our awareness. And when we had concluded all of that, we decided it was important for us to not only issue a report of our learning journey and what we knew and what we heard, what we understood by the data, and then ask for a call to action and ask through a coalition that any CEO in any company could join us. Our commitment is really about ensuring that inside the companies, there is a welcome mat, there's promotional opportunities, there is opportunities for business, Black-owned businesses to grow, supplier chains to grow. We've committed $5 billion over the first 5 years to make sure that whatever resources are necessary for us to accomplish the goals can be accomplished. And so we're now working as a large coalition, hiring an executive director. Fundamentally, at the end of the day, we not only believe we've got work to do and that it's imperative and it's urgent, but we also believe that unlike times past, it's not a passing fad. We need to stay focused, stay committed. It has to last past this CEO who happens to be an incumbent today. We have to sustain the effort if we're really fundamentally going to have the kind of equity that we want in our workplaces and in our community, where we will advocate, for example, for kids in school, for housing, for financing for homes. So that's the kind of work that we've embarked upon.
So on that last point, in the past, at moments like this, people have said, well, you know, a lot of good intentions, but nothing really changed. How are we going to make sure that this time it's different?
So I come from the generation that thought in the late 60s, early 70s, when this issue was front and center, that we had made significant change and we had set a course that we would all be proud of. Now, I'm not going to deny change was made, but it was not a course that we can all be proud of. In the long haul, we failed to continue to monitor successes and failures, what was happening in the country in terms of institutional or systemic racism. So what we've committed to do in our effort is, one, we want total transparency. So on a periodic basis, we will report out exactly whether we've accomplished our respective commitments or failed and what course corrections we intend to take. At the same time, we've asked the state government to take the report that we provided, which really wasn't just about business, but about racial inequity in the state, and do it every 2 years so that we as a public, we as Washingtonians, know what progress we're making in terms of racial equity and what we're not, and give us the opportunity to transparently look at it and to make course correction. COVID has really put an exclamation point on this. We understood the unemployment rate pre-COVID. We never understood it, really, at the end of the day, until we saw what happened as a result of COVID. The health inequities. So what we try to do in our report is look across the dimensions of the life of a Black Washingtonian, whether it was future economic prosperity by ownership of a home and that you can pass it on to a next generation, or the health disparities, or the criminal justice system disparities, or the educational disparities, or the disparities inside our companies. And so we're trying to monitor all of that to say, are we making a change? Is it sustainable? Will it make a difference over the long haul? And if not, we need to revisit and re-ask and reimagine what course we need to change so we can accomplish the goal.
Like what you hear so far? Make sure you never miss a show by clicking on the subscribe button now. This podcast is made possible by listeners like you. Thank you for your support. Now back to the show. You mentioned that you and the other leaders went through some training and that sort of thing. And I'm just curious, have you, as a leader, have you found yourself having to respond and stretch to this issue in the last year or so? How has it impacted you directly?
You know, I've always been a racial equity advocate. And so I felt comfortable about what I thought I knew, what I thought I understood, and what we needed to do. And now I reflect back and say, I did not. And so the decision that we made at the beginning in early June to go on a listening, learning journey was the right decision for all of us. And it's changed my life. I've read more now on the subject than I'd ever read before. I've listened a lot to those who've had the lived experience. And I have so much better of an understanding than what I did before. Our CEOs, I don't know that they would have signed the commitment back in June, that they were very willing to sign when we issued it in early December. And that was because they too decided, I want to hear, I want to understand, I want to educate myself, I want to talk to my Black employees, I want to make progress and I don't know how. So this journey is one that I would recommend to anybody. There's a lot to learn, and it's a continuous journey. I don't think it will ever end for any of us. But it's one that really, I think, is what's necessary for us to make the kind of change that really needs to be made.
That's good advice for all of us and good advice for our students. And speaking of our students, I would be remiss as the dean if I didn't ask the following question on their behalf, because normally, you know, speakers are coming to campus and they're getting to talk to students directly, and they address the students directly, or and the students ask them questions. So my question is pretty simple. It's, you know, what advice will you have for recent college graduates, particularly in this pandemic environment? Or another way to frame it is, what do you know now that you wish you knew when you graduated from UW and you want to pass on?
Well, first of all, I will say to you, Dean, I would much have preferred to have engaged, no comment to you, but with students directly. And so, and I feel, quite frankly, for these students, whether it's the kindergartner or the graduate student who've had to experience what they have over the course of the last year because of COVID. But I don't think the lesson that I learned back then is any different than the one I would express now. So this isn't a COVID lesson. This is a life learned lesson. And that is, when I graduated, I had a teaching certificate and I couldn't find a job. And so I went to the newspaper and I picked up a ad to be a clerk typist too for adult probation and parole in the central area of Seattle. And you might laugh or criticize or what have you, and I have no regrets. I can't tell you how much I learned in that year. It was a little over a year when I found job openings thereafter. You know, I remember something that I also shared with a recent retiree. Both he and I happened to end up at Harvard as fellows at the Harvard Kennedy School. And he was the immediate past CEO of Turner Broadcasting, CNN and others. And he and I didn't feel that we would necessarily see eye to eye, because he's media, I'm politician. In fact, we saw eye to eye continuously. And the one thing we tried to impart on all of our students then was that whatever you end up doing, don't assume that's your lifelong job. Too often we think, I need to get out of school and pick my career and stick with it. That's just not necessarily true. Great if that's what you do and it works for you, but don't get excited if it doesn't. But whatever job you do, give it your all. Focus on it. As politicians say, don't look to the next person you can introduce yourself to, but focus on that job and do your best. And if you do, doors will open automatically. That is my career. Did I ever set out to be attorney general or governor? Never in my lifetime did I. But doors opened for me, and on occasion I didn't walk through, but more often than not, I did. And so for career path, whatever you land on, do it well. Let the doors open, make the decision, the personal decision. Do I walk through that door or wait for another door? And let the sky be the limit. Do not assume that one job is the be-all, end-all. But let yourself continuously think about what other opportunities are out there that I might want to take up. And I will, on a personal ask, if you will let me, Dean, along the line, will you please think about running for office? Because if it's not you, then who will it be? And you're among the best and the brightest, so we need you desperately. And along the way, whatever you do, please give back to your community. If you don't run for office, there are plenty of ways to make your community better, and I think that's the responsibility of all of us.
Well, that's good advice anytime, but particularly in a recession, it's probably even better advice when you get out and you're looking for something. And you've kind of segue into my next question, which presumed that when you graduated, you did not know you would run for governor someday. So that was a long journey. You have, you know, decades of wonderful public service. So thank you so much for that. But what were the key moments leading up to your decision to run for governor in the early 2000s? How did you get there? What were a couple of the key twists and turns?
John Kennedy was my era of high school and college. And he called all of us to public service. In many ways, it didn't mean you had to be a public servant or, for that matter, run for office, but you had to give back, as I just mentioned a bit ago. And it was that call to public service that really, really resonated with me. So I went out with the idea that I could save the world. I became a caseworker and realized I wasn't saving the world. So I went to law school and thought there might be the opportunity for me to do something big and really have a positive impact on people's lives. Again, no regrets. It did provide that opportunity for me. I ended up with major, major cases. Tobacco settlement, largest settlement in the history of the world, then and now, which really literally, ultimately, more importantly, saved lives. You know, if I could have applied to be Attorney General, I would have. But running for office was quite scary for me. I hadn't run for any other office. And I had some mentors, not the least of which was the governor, who had appointed me as the head of the Department of Ecology, as you mentioned, and who encouraged me to consider running. Now, I'm not going to say that was an easy go. First debate, for example, elderly gentleman, back of the room after the debate, asked me again what I was running for, and I explained I was running for attorney general. He shook his head no, and I asked why was he saying no, and he said because women shouldn't be generals. I tried to explain this wasn't a military job, but to no avail. And so it was that first debate I went home to my husband and said, this is going to be a long haul. But I was fortunate enough with a wonderful general election opponent to win. That allowed me to really make an impact, which was important to me. But then I began looking at the legislative body was continuously adopting new laws, some of which were unconstitutional, and no matter what I would say to them, they would pass it anyway. And of course, we would go to court, and of course, we would lose. And so I began to ask myself, being governor would provide me a much better opportunity to make the kind of impact that could be done legally that I wasn't able to do as attorney general. So it's that beginning with John Kennedy that led me on that course of giving back, wanting to make a difference. And I think I've been very blessed at the opportunities life has given me.
Great. You said you decided to run for governor to have more impact. So I'm wondering what now, in looking back, you think was the most important thing you accomplished as governor?
So, you know, I'd like to say it was something real specific, but the truth be told, seeing us through that recession was the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. Emotional as all get out. It was a literal roller coaster. The kinds of cuts that we had to make were heart-wrenching and heartbreaking. But at the end of the day, I asked my team to focus on the human factors. If we were to make a cut, I would say, I'm the person that's getting that benefit. What does it mean when you cut me? And we let that drive us. We asked for help from the church, faith community, nonprofits, and so on. And we saw our way through that recession, and we did so in a way that we came out of it very robust. So I think probably at the end, that's it. But I'm proud of the 520 bridge. I'm proud of the tunnel. I'm proud of us saying the best thing we can do to educate our children is early childhood education. I'm proud of opening up the doors for higher education. I'm proud of being the first state in the nation to cover all poor children for health care, and modeling some health care innovations that became a part of the Obamacare era. So we did a lot of things that I'm proud of at the end of the day, but probably the one that was the most difficult and the one that we did ultimately, who knew at the time, as best we could, now did we make mistakes, of course, is pulling us out of the worst recession since the Depression.
Thank you. Fast forward to right now, today, what do you think today's biggest challenge for a business leader is? And how have you been encouraging the leaders you work with, for example, at Challenge Seattle? How have you encouraged them to take on these challenges, or how have you advised them around this challenge?
You know, it's interesting that I would end up leading this organization, never having worked for business in my life, but I'm not sure that wasn't a confluence of circumstances. When you poll today and ask the public, who do you trust? I don't know if you know this, Dean. Who do you trust? Some would be surprised when I say this, but it's business. It's business. And so I have conveyed to my CEOs that with that public trust comes a responsibility. And what the public is saying is, you're responsible to help solve some of these problems. You can't, you know, finger point, you can't blame, you can't do any of that anymore. You have to exercise the leadership to solve some of these most pressing problems. And I fundamentally believe that's their big issue right now. And it's not something that they necessarily have been always comfortable with because they've not been asked to do it before. But boy, are they doing a good job, I will say to you. The kinds of things that they're doing in this public-private partnership on COVID is nothing short of amazing. When we had our first conversation with the governor about how could we help, we were very clear. We don't make public health decisions. We're not educated or informed or experts. But in the case of Starbucks, deliver 100 million cups of coffee every week worldwide to satisfied customers. There's something there that we can share for shots in arms. And we've done so. Our public-private partnership is unique in the country. No one else has stood up a command center at a Department of Health like ours with support coming from the private sector, where we're loaning people all the time. As far as we know, no one has ever stood up what we stood up just this past week, which is a vaccine locator, backed up with a 211 call center. That's all being driven by this public-private partnership. Or when a mass vaccination site was set up in Southwest Washington, a global team from Starbucks went to look at it and gave them suggestions which increased their output by 30%. That's what I say to them, you're called to do today. And maybe you didn't do it yesterday. All you were asked to do was pay. Well, you're no longer just being asked to pay. You're being asked to participate and lead and partner. And they're doing it.
You know, I'm so happy to hear you say some of these things about the role of business in solving society's problems. That's a theme we emphasize for our students, and we don't think there's any problem out there that doesn't involve the business sector one way or the other. So thank you for bringing that out.
Totally agree with you.
You mentioned it's ironic that you are leading Challenge Seattle, even though you were never a business leader, but you were a leader. And I'm sure that that's what led to you leading that initiative. So I want to turn around a little bit and talk about leadership with you. And ask you first, how would you describe your leadership style? Or if you don't want to do it, how do you think the people that you've worked most closely with over the years would? What are two or three leadership qualities that you think are most important if somebody's truly going to be successful as a leader?
I think others would say that I live by what I suggest, which is you have to have really good listening skills. And you have to surround yourself with the best and the brightest. Not assume you have to be the one person in the room who's smarter than anybody else. That is a ticket, in my personal opinion, for failure. The brighter the people around the table, the more diverse the people are around the table, the better off you are in addressing the problems that you'll have to confront. And you have to listen to them. And I mean, really listen. Oftentimes with people, I have found myself with citizens who treat me like I'm the typical politician. And I may be looking at them, but I'm not hearing them. So I repeat what they say, and I say, have I got that right? And you should see how they react. Well, that's the same with employees. When you listen, but you really do listen, and you hear what they have to say, that makes your organization better, in my opinion. Work hard. Expectations need to be realistic. People have families, and it's important to recognize that. Take risks. Well-informed risks. So with the problems that we've got today, whether it's in business or society or whatever, the tried old ways of doing business are not going to succeed. We have to be willing to take risks, but they have to be thoughtful and well-informed. When we don't succeed, we pick ourselves up and we go back out, having learned what we learned from that experience. And at the end of the day, expectations of the people with whom you work should be high. And when they know what the expectations are and that they are high, trust me, they'll meet. They'll meet those expectations. So don't be afraid. Don't be abusive. don't overdo, but have high expectations and make them known, make them understood, and invite criticism, invite disagreement. Again, that's what makes you better at what you do and makes your organization ultimately better.
Great. Those are really valuable lessons for our students to know as they go out there and try to lead wherever they are. Leaders sometimes have to be follower, right? And so are these the things you look for in somebody that you're working with when you're not necessarily the person in charge?
I do. I really do. Whether it's in business now that I've been involved in what I'm doing, whether it's in business or it's in elected office or whatever it may be, I'm looking for people who will respect others, respect differing opinions, invite different opinions, who listen and hear and disagree. That's all healthy. I'm looking for someone who's got a vision, who wants those expectations to achieve that vision set clear for the employees or the public or what have you. And if you do those things and you really are a part, it's a team, there's not a whole lot you can't accomplish, in my opinion.
Great. Thank you so much, Governor, for those insights on leadership. And again, thank you for being with us today and for your decades of marvelous public service to the state of Washington, because you've been doing great work for, what, since the 80s? So that's amazing in many different capacities. So we really appreciate that. And you're still doing wonderful things with Challenge Seattle. So again, thank you for being with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Anytime.
Like I said, we're going to bring you back to campus when we can get there.
Sounds great to me.
Thank you so much.
You bet. Be safe. Be well.
You've been listening to the Leadership Playbook, the podcast edition of the Albers Executive Speaker Series at Seattle University. If you enjoyed what you heard today, consider telling a friend and give us a good rating on iTunes. You can subscribe to our show for free on your favorite podcast app or find us online at leadershipplaybook.org. Find out who our next guests are by following us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. I'm Joe Phillips, the Dean of the Albers School of Business and Economics. Thanks for listening.